Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on Open Line, we'll talk about the science of climate change, the evidence for global warming, the choices facing policymakers in terms of how to combat global warming, or at the very least, adapt to it. This half hour, what do we know about global warming, and what do we need to do as a national and world community to deal with it? Two different points of view. Joining us from Toronto, Ontario, Stephen McIntyre, his questioning of some climate change science set off a big controversy which eventually involved Congress and the National Academy of Sciences. Steve McIntyre worked in mineral exploration for 30 years. He's been a policy analyst for the Canadian government, has degrees in mathematics and economics, and I guess speaks here at The Ohio State University tomorrow. We'll tell you more about that. Welcome, Steve McIntyre. Good to have you here.
Hi, nice to be here, Fred.
Joining us in our studios, Mohan Wali is professor in the School of Environment and Natural Resources here at The Ohio State University and director of the Environmental Science Graduate Program here at OSU. Mohan Wali, good to have you here as well.
Very welcome.
And we're at 614-292-8513. That is the number to call. You can email the question to openline@wosu.org. Well, let me first ask you a kind of very basic question. Just, you know, what would the, for our intelligent, educated, open line audience, what do we know about global warming to a reasonable certainty in terms of potentially difficult or catastrophic even effects for humankind? And therefore, what should we say to policymakers, given the state of knowledge, that they ought to be doing about it? Let me ask both of the questions. Mohan Wali first. What do we know?
Well, we know quite a bit about global warming now, not just from one line of evidence, but a whole bunch of things. We have got data now from ice cores. We have got data from tree rings. We have got data actually from what increased carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is doing to plants and animals. And all of these put together put a tremendous responsibility on us to make sure that we start acting, we start in reducing the carbon dioxide that we are emitting into the atmosphere, mm-hmm. and other gases like methane and so on. So I think we are well past the stage where we should be just talking about whether it is or it's not, because evidence clearly suggests that human-induced emissions and so on are changing the climate. And one of the problems with just the change in temperature is that it's also doing a whole bunch of things. It's having its effect on precipitation patterns and so on, which has a tremendous impact on agricultural production, forest production, and so on. So I think we are well past this stage where we should be debating really what we should do.
So we see international programs in various nations saying they're going to have mandatory curbs on greenhouse gas emissions for industry, et cetera. We're at the stage where you feel it's urgent that we do that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Steve McIntyre, same question to you. What do we know about global warming, and what ought we to be doing about it?
Well, let me begin by saying that I've not suggested that governments should not make policy decisions based on uncertain information. I think people make decisions all the time. If I had a big policy job, I would be guided by the opinions of large institutions. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I've gone to the trouble of actually analyzing the tree ring data, the ice core data that underpins the argument that sort of the 1990s are supposedly the warmest decade in the past 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. And when you actually drill down into the data and see what it says, what I found is that the data is poorly analyzed statistically. The conclusions do not follow from the data. In some cases, there are relatively elementary statistical errors. The authors are resistant to archiving their data, in many cases refusing to make their data available for examination. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that politicians defer any decisions pending what I think is a need for much improved performance in these areas. But I think that scientists that are asking us to rely on their results should be required to archive their data in some, and that that data should be available for inspection by other people.
Okay.
And in particular, to the one question that I've examined in detail, and which caused considerable controversy, I don't think there's really there's no convincing evidence in my mind that the tree ring data and the ice core data show that it is, say, warmer in 1998 than it was in the 11th century. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't control carbon dioxide emissions. It just simply means that many of the arguments are don't do what they say they're going to do.
Sure. So you would say, then, Steve, on a practical level, if a leader of the United States approached you and say, you know, John McCain comes to you, if he were elected president, and he says to you, look, what should I do? Should I enter into like a Kyoto-like accord? Should we have mandatory, you know, lessening of greenhouse gas emissions? You would say what?
Well, I would say that, you know, politicians will decide what they're going to decide, but I would say that I would certainly require scientists to archive their data, to archive their methods, to provide full disclosure of adverse results, and so that you have the best possible information available for decision making. I would try to improve the programs of due diligence on the studies so that you have some truly independent reports on climate models. But if you had to make a decision in the next 2 minutes, I mean, I think it's prudent to build nuclear reactors. I mean, I mentioned to you in our pre-interview that I'm from Ontario. Half
yes.
our power is nuclear, and I'm quite happy that it is.
Because it limits carbon emissions, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, I mean, and ultimately, there's no harm, you know, I see no harm in limiting them
sure.
in that sense.
Sure. Okay. Moana Welly, Steve McIntyre has said, look, the science in some cases has been a little sloppy. Scientists maybe need to be more rigorous in terms of their data and the release of data to the public. Have climate scientists been a little negligent here?
Well, I would never disagree with Steve when he says that scientists ought to be careful about the exact methodology that you use and everything else. And so there's no argument. I'm, in fact, delighted to hear from him that he, too, would like some action, and sooner than later. There are two problems here. One is that it's not so much the scientists who are supposed to be putting data in the open. That is the scientific tradition. But it's also the systems themselves, the complexity of what we are dealing with. You know, in the 70s, we were dealing with the atmospheric models, and this started solely from the military interested in knowing about weather and so on. In the 80s, we said, hey, you can't build atmospheric models without the land surface if you want to get any environmental conclusions from it. Then in the 90s, we started looking at not just the atmosphere, but atmosphere and land surface and ocean surface. And so we said we have got to include the oceans in the model. And as 90s proceeded, and as we come to the present day, we are now talking about the dynamism of vegetation. We are talking about the effect of aerosols. We're talking about atmospheric chemistry. So the whole system is so immensely complex.
Lots of variables, many variables.
Right,
yeah.
And that's what sometimes, you know, throws us off the course. But the progress that has been made in the last two decades is absolutely phenomenal. But the point from Steve is very well taken, that scientists have to be careful, as they should be. And that's nothing new, because
well,
that is a normal course.
In the case of the data that Professor Waleed mentioned at the start, tree ring data and ice core data, there's absolutely no obstacle to that data being properly archived. The data sets are rather small in data processing terms, and yet the reaction it has been, for example, Phil Jones, who produces the world-famous CRU temperature history, refused to even identify the stations that were used in his temperature history, even under Freedom of Information inquiries, refused to provide that data. His excuse to what has been, why should I provide that data to you when your only objective is to find something wrong with it? Hmm. A famous tree ring author, Jacoby, archived 10 out of 36 series. I asked for the other 26, and he said he only archived the ones that produced the most temperature-sensitive results.
Steve, when you say
archive, that's what he was paid to do.
Yeah, Steve, when you say archive, you mean simply make them available to other scientists to examine.
There are public data banks that scientists can sort of digitally archive their measurements so that those are available for posterity. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a policy requirement of the United States government that be done. And those policies are flouted by climate scientists. The journals don't enforce them. And the IPCC doesn't enforce it. I was a reviewer for the IPCC.
And explain to our listeners what the IPCC is.
The IPCC is the International Panel on Climate Change, mm-hmm. Which produces the prominent reports that the public hears. And
sure.
I was a reviewer for the last report. In one case, I asked to see the supporting data for one unpublished study that was being cited in the report. The authors refused to provide it. The IPCC refused to ask the authors to provide it.
So, Steve, let me ask you, why do you think
expel me as a reviewer if I asked the authors?
Do you think that the climate scientists, in your experience, are simply not providing data that you would think? I would imagine that most scientists in most endeavors would provide.
Well, I think in one sense they're not used to the level of public scrutiny that is now involved. Nobody likes their data to be cross-examined.
Okay.
It's nobody wants to be audited. But what happens is that when you change things from a discussion in a seminar room, then the rules and practices that maybe were appropriate 20 years ago when it was simply an academic issue no longer apply. If people are in effect issuing public scientific prospectuses, then there needs to be an open kimono policy that the data has to be if it's used in an international scientific document, data has to be made available. And that, in my opinion, should just be a red-letter rule. There shouldn't be any argument about it. It's crazy that it's an issue.
Steve McIntyre joining us from Toronto. Steve, I want to mention you're going to be speaking here tomorrow, Friday, at the Ohio State University, hosted by the OSU Department of Mechanical Engineering. And my guest will be speaking at 2:30 in the afternoon at Scott Lab, room E001. Let me tell you where Scott Lab is. It's 201 West 19th Avenue. It's at 2:30 in the afternoon. This is a graduate seminar, but it's free and open to the public to attend. 2:30 p.m. Scott Lab Room E001. And I'm told to find that room. When you go in, it's not on the first floor. You have to take a stairway down to the basement. So in case you're looking tomorrow at 2:30, Steve McIntyre. And Mohan Wale, professor in the School of Environment and Natural Resources here at OSU and director of the Environmental Science Graduate Program here. 614-292-8513 or email open line at WOSU.org. Let me ask you both. We hear some people saying, and I know, Steve, you're not saying this, but we hear some people saying, look, we deny that human activity is a significant factor in terms of the global warming that is occurring, and therefore we do not need to take these steps in terms of reduction of carbon emissions because there is no reason to think that human activity in producing greenhouse gases has any significant effect at all on global warming. Let me ask both of you, beginning with Mohan Wale, what you think of that point of view. Mohan, you first.
Well, the point is, where is all of this gas going? Where are all of these gases that we emit every year? Where are they going? And that's a very important point. For example, we have the pool of concentration in the atmosphere is about 750 billion. We pump in another 25 billion or more every year, year after year. And this is chronic. Now, let me go back to a couple of points that Dr. McIntyre made. And first of all, I share his frustration because as a scientist, we have to have access to the data, except what happens in his particular case on the hockey stick thing was that it became a circus. You know, the Congress moved in and they wanted to have each and every file of raw data and everything else.
We should say what you mean by the hockey stick thing. What is that?
Well, what happened was that these authors actually combined data sets from different ways that they were collected.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gave a pattern. And incidentally, the guys who produced the data did not call it that. In other words, it just showed a quick spike in temperature
that looked
in the recent
like a
years.
Stick.
That's right.
A quick spike in temperature in recent years.
Absolutely. Okay. So I share his view, and I think properly we should go ahead and do it. But at the same time, I want to tell Steve that early in the 20th century and late 19th century, Johann Gregor Mendel, the father of modern genetics, is reputed to have been an excellent stat person. You know, he deleted some of his data when he did experiments on peas. You see, he was trying to find out how peas transfer their genes to the progeny. And he is supposed to have been an excellent math person and statistical guy in presenting only those data that conform to the thing. And yet, all of his observations have, in retrospect, been proved to be correct.
Mm-hmm. But what about people who say, look, there simply isn't any evidence that human activity is causing global warming sufficiently?
Let me just respond to that point about not reporting data. I have a lot of experience in the mineral exploration business, and in that case, if people have bad drill holes, they have to report them. I mean, the idea of not reporting adverse results is something that simply can't be justified, in my view. And if it comes out okay in the end, well, that's good luck rather than good management.
Mm-hmm.
As a society, in terms of making management choices, I think it's pretty clear that you need to have bad results and adverse results on the table, as well as cherry-pick good results.
Okay.
And the fact that some guy got lucky 150 years ago doesn't affect that simple policy.
Steve, understood. That seems very reasonable. But let me ask you again, what about people who say there's simply no evidence that human activity is a significant cause of global warming, so we shouldn't be making all these national policies and international policies of reducing greenhouse gas emissions? What do you think of that point of view?
Well,
is there still a debate about this at all, or is the debate over?
Well, my position is fairly nuanced in the sense that I'd say if I had a big policy job right now, if
mm-hmm.
I was the Secretary of the Environment in the U.S. or something
yeah.
like that, or Minister of the Environment in Canada, I would take the advice of large institutions like the International Panel on Climate Change.
Mm-hmm.
I would not take the views that I might think personally on things. I think you have to be guided by the views of institutions. So I, in that sense, as policymakers, can't indulge in sort of personal whims or
mm-hmm,
personal
sure.
or personal theories.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, with the experience that I have in trying to verify these results, I think as a policymaker, I would do what I could to hold the feet to the fire of the modelers and the climate scientists
mm-hmm.
in a far more rigorous way than they are right now.
Okay.
And I mean, the United States of all countries should know the idea of making decisions on bad information.
Sure.
So I think that policy and the scientific process right now is not managed particularly well. in order to generate results for policymakers. Okay, I mean, the due diligence is poor, and I would do what I could to improve that process. And I would view that as being very healthy in the sense that you then end up with
More certain data, better data. Yeah. Mohan Wali, we're running out of time. Mohan Wali, let me ask you then. So Steve McIntyre is just saying, look, if you're a policymaker now, you'd have to go with what the International Panel on Climate is saying, which is, you know, let's really drastically cut these greenhouse gas emissions. But he's saying, look, the scientific community, some people in the scientific community in terms of global warming have been awfully sloppy. We need better data. Do you think we need better data?
I totally agree with Steve when he says that all of the data should be available. We should be more rigorous, and there is no question in my mind. On that point, we don't disagree at all. I'm tremendously heartened by his saying that Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was established by the World Meteorological Organization and the United Nations and has now produced the fourth assessment report, are groups of people who we should listen to. And that is a tremendous thing, because I did not know where Dr. McIntyre actually stood.
Well, let me nuance it. I mean, in terms of their comments on any particular issues that I've been involved with, I think their comments are incorrect. They're biased. They're poorly done. All I'm saying is that until one has any alternative view, that as a policymaker, you can't just, throw up your hands at it. But having said that, I mean, my personal knowledge is on the hockey stick stuff, it's abysmally done. Mm-hmm. It's inaccurate. It's biased. It's unrepresentative. But, if I was a policymaker, I'd still have to go with that rather than sort of what I knew personally.
Okay, so those who are not represented here today, who say, and there are those voices who say, look, it's really clear that human activity is, there's no evidence that human activity is causing a substantial increase in global warming. Are we saying that those people are insincere, that they're paid for by industry, or what are we saying? They're just wrongheaded. The debate is over, isn't it?
Well, one aspect of the debate, in a sense, hasn't changed in 30 years. In 1979, the Charney Report estimated that the impact of doubling CO2 would be 2.5 degrees plus or minus a degree and a half. And in 2007, the IPCC made almost exactly the same conclusion with exactly the same error bars. So in 30 years and billions of dollars of research, the error bars in that estimate have not narrowed 1 millimeter. So that in one sense you'd have to say is a disappointing performance by the climate science community, and that in managing it, you'd like to see a better performance in the next 30 years.
Understand. Mohan Wali, quick statement from you, and then we have
But better performance by scientists does not negate the fact that there is global warming and that we are putting greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, in quantities that are going to produce feedback mechanisms.
All right. And we must conclude. I would like to thank you both for a very nice discussion. Steve McIntyre from Toronto, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Professor Wally. Nice to talk to you.
Hey, we're delighted to have you here. Welcome to Columbus.
Mohan Wali, professor in the School of Natural Resources. Thank you for being here as well. When we come back, we'll talk about the resignation of Attorney General Mark Dan with Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Traveling on the airlines is confusing, frustrating, and expensive. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Scott McCartney. He writes about the airline industry in his Wall Street Journal column, The Middle Seat. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air will be here later this afternoon. It begins at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. It is 58 degrees at 10:30. Corporate partners help provide support for the programming on WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, active audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national brand the community relies on for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820. Weekend Edition brings you perspective on the week's news with in-depth reporting, interviews, and commentaries. Start your weekend off with hosts Scott Simon and Leanne Hansen. Tune into Weekend Edition Saturday and Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. on WOSU 89.7 FM. In the weather forecast for today, cloudy skies and scattered rain showers later today, a high of 65. Numerous showers are expected tonight, a low of 48. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on Open Line, as you very well know, I'm sure, yesterday Ohio Attorney General Mark Dan resigned following the filing of articles of impeachment by Democrats in the House. Governor Ted Strickland called it a sad day for Ohio, but said he was pleased that the Attorney General had resigned. Ohio Public Radio State House News reporter Joe Ingles has been covering the story. Welcome back, Joe. Good to have
Hello,
you here.
Hello, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513. You, by the way, a sidebar here. You broke a story that you just put on the website for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau that one of the two women who brought these initial charges of sexual harassment against the former attorney general has been threatened.
Yes, Rex Elliott, the attorney for Cindy Stankowski, says that she has been threatened. There was a call yesterday made to the attorney general's office asking for her address so that this person could send her something for bringing down the state of Ohio. That has been taken as a threat. The attorney general's office, the spokesman over there, says he's not aware of it, but he's checking into it. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to figure out what's going on here with this situation, but she is very upset about this.
I can imagine. So, and again, we have no idea the source of the threat. I mean, it could be anyone in the public at all.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Mark Dan resigned, and we noticed that his wife did not stand by his side, as has been traditional in these situations, but one of his 23-year-old daughter did.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Strickland said there were no deals, no soft landings, no job offers for the former attorney general. Is that right?
That's right. He said that that was not something that they dealt with, talked about, were concerned about.
Mm-hmm. So the governor said, by the way, we'd like your comments here at 614-292-8513. Do you feel this is the correct move by the attorney general? Do you feel that it's damaged the Democratic Party? Do you feel that it's in any way damaged the reputation of the state of Ohio? You can email questions to openline at wosu.org. Joe, in that regard, Governor Strickland says he does not expect there to be political damage to the Democratic Party because he says he and the party acted quickly to call for resignation of the former attorney general and impeachment. On the other hand, Republicans say they're really going to press this issue in the November election.
Well, and that's the case. I mean, we've got an investigation that's going on now with Inspector Tom Charles looking into this situation. That is going to keep this story in the news in a very valid way. And so people are going to be talking about it still, even though Mark Dan is not the attorney general anymore. You know, the thing is that Governor Strickland says, you know, the minute we knew about it, we acted in a very strong way. We have made sure that we got, you know, we did everything we could to get him out of office. And, you know, they point out that when Governor Taft was under fire and actually was convicted of ethics violations, that the Republicans did not react in this way to the problems in his office. And so it's kind of an attitude of, you know, if they bring that up, we'll bring, you know, the way they handle Governor Taft up as well.
Yeah. Now, Thomas Charles, the inspector general, he has quite a track record, does he not, in uncovering quite a bit of wrongdoing, including former Governor Bob Taft?
Right. Tom Charles has, he really is a bulldog in a way. When he goes after an investigation, he tends to come up with information that either results in someone being fired or someone charges being brought against someone. We know that Robert Congdon, the former head of the Consumers Council, was fired after an investigation Tom Charles's office. And as you mentioned, Governor Taft, his situation, Tom Charles was able to uncover problems there that led to the conviction.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there any indication now they sealed off the Attorney General's office? Is that right? They took computers, they took other items, and the State Highway Patrol is guarding. Is that right?
Well, yesterday morning, they took out computer hard drives, files, electronic equipment. We saw them bringing that out, and a dozen investigators from Tom Charles's office were in Ohio Attorney General Mark Dan's office first thing yesterday morning. Now, you know, here's the thing, Fred. The bill that allowed, or the law that allows Tom Charles to do this investigation, was just signed into law the night before. Mm-hmm. So within a 12-hour period, they're over there investigating this. So they are taking it very seriously. They're talking to people, and they are getting evidence as we speak.
And Mark Dan tried to prevent that bill from going through, right? He said it would cause a lot of problems for him, and he didn't want, as part of a deal, he tried to get that investigation, at least the immediacy of the investigation, stopped. Huh?
Correct. One of his friends from the Mahoning Valley, Bob Hagan, a lawmaker down here, was approached by Mark Dan's attorney and was asked to take a deal, if you will, to Senate President Bill Harris. And basically that deal consisted of, hey, if you take this emergency clause off this bill, Mark Dan will resign immediately. Now, what that means is the emergency clause allows the investigation to go on right away, right now.
Mm-hmm.
If that emergency clause wasn't there, the investigation couldn't have begun for 90 days.
Yeah. Joe, is there any way of estimating how long this Inspector General's investigation will go on? I mean, it seems like it's likely to go right up to and through the November election. Is that possible?
That is very possible. I mean, this is an open-ended investigation, and the people who are authorizing this investigation, and it's important to note that Governor Strickland signed it into law readily. He's been calling for an independent investigation. They want to get to the bottom of this, and it might take some time to do that. So it could very well go into the fall during the election season.
We're discussing issues surrounding the resignation of Attorney General Mark Dan here in Ohio with Ohio State House News reporter Joe Ingles joining us on the phone. And we're at 614-292-8513. You can email a comment or question to openline@wosu.org. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hey, Joe. Hey, Fred. I just, they asked me what my comment was, and I said, neener, 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 neener. Because when I watched Mark Dan, even before I knew anything about this, you know, it made me think of, you know, he doth protest too much because he was filing lawsuits left and right. And, you know, it's very Elliot Spitzer-esque. You know, I think he was making up for his lack of real, for what he was doing wrong by filing, you know, what he was doing wrong in private by what he, you know, what he did in public. He was trying to compensate for that. And there's a Bible scripture that reminds me of him. What you do in secret, you will be rewarded openly for.
Okay.
That's my comment.
Jim, appreciate your comment.
Sure.
In fact, in his letter of resignation, we have a Shakespearean and biblical quotes here, and I guess in his letter of resignation, Joe, that Mark Dan uses a Shakespearean quote to the effect that the evil that men do lives long after them. The good is often interred with their bones, and he quoted that with regard to himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Mark Dan has definitely been a watchdog in state government when Governor Taft, when the situation was going on with him. We saw Mark Dan out there on the forefront railing against Governor Taft and the Republicans for the way they were handling that situation. In fact, his slogan, Mark Dan's slogan, was "We will stop the corruption." And it's kind of ironic that 16 months later, we're sitting here and Mark Dan has resigned under a scandal of problems.
17 months in office, approximately, Joe, what could we say were the accomplishments of the former attorney general?
Well, you know, the Attorney General is being credited for strong consumer protection. He has gone after predatory lenders. He has taken some environmental situations, you know, taken some stands on that to try to clean up the environment. He has, you know, been doing these town meetings, if you will, across the state on payday lenders, trying to stop abuses there. He has been a consumer advocate, and a lot of his successes so far in that area, a lot of his backers say, you know, look at this. He has done something important, and, you know, that's something that he has done, but that at the same time, there's been all these problems that have surfaced since he's been in office, and they just keep compounding themselves, so it kind of takes away from the good that he does when all this other comes out.
Now, the Inspector General is investigating, but there are other investigations ongoing, right?
Correct. There are many investigations ongoing. We have an investigation, as you mentioned, from the Inspector General, and that is the big one. But then there is also the Highway Patrol that's looking into whether state vehicles were used properly. We have an investigation into whether whether people were coerced in this investigation into saying something. We also have investigations from Mary Taylor, our auditor, is looking into the office over there to see how the money is spent and what's going on with that. There's six, I think, about six different investigations going on, and it's going to be Inspector General Tom Charles's job to pull all those together and try to do something with those.
There's been a report that the Federal Bureau of Investigation could be investigating or might be investigating the former Attorney General with regard to gambling, these gambling machines that, of course, were removed from the state. What do we know about that?
Well, we do know that the Columbus Dispatch has cited sources that have told them that this investigation is going on by the FBI. We know that last year when the gambling industry was when they were dealing with those tic-tac fruit games, mm-hmm. and Mark Dan was taking stands on that, we do know that his security level went way up, that there was something going on there that precipitated Mark Dan needing more security protection, and his costs went way up at that point. So, but what is happening there, I really can't tell you, and I think that that might come out in this investigation, and we'll just have to wait and see.
As I understand it, according to the Columbus Dispatch report, these gambling interests who, among other things, had these so-called skill games, which are now banned mm-hmm. in Ohio, so that we can have Keno, I guess. you know, they contributed about $200,000 to his campaign for Attorney General. At least according to the testimony of some of the gambling people, they said that he promised them, Mark Dan did promise them he would be neutral about them, that he wouldn't be terribly opposed to these machines. They contribute $200,000. Then he turns around and knocks off the machines in the state. And it is, and I think those gambling interests seem to feel, at least as they talk to the dispatch, a little betrayed. And you're right. The former Attorney General took $33,500 of his campaign money and used it to increase security for his home in Youngstown, claiming I don't know what. Maybe that the implication is threats from the gambling industry. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't know, but it certainly happened around the same time. So, you know, we know that there was some sort of problem there, and that has been ongoing for quite some time now.
We're at 614-292-8513. We're talking about issues raised by and circumstances surrounding the resignation of now former Attorney General Mark Dan. And you can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Again, we're with Joe Ingles, Ohio Public Radio State House news reporter. So, Joe, what does the law provide now? The first assistant attorney general is now at least temporarily in charge. Is that right?
Yes, that's Tom Winters. He is the first assistant attorney general, and he is temporarily in charge until the governor appoints someone to take that position on an interim basis. the governor says he will appoint someone to take that position on an interim basis, and then that person could or could not run for election in the fall. There are 2 years left, a little more than 2 years left in the term of Mark Dan as Attorney General, that term. So whoever comes in the fall will serve 2 years. The Republicans will no doubt put up a candidate for that position. And then whoever that gets elected in the fall will have to go back up for re-election in 2 years from now.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the governor has a couple of choices. He apparently could appoint a caretaker now, attorney general, mm-hmm. who would sort of preside over the office while the inspector general's investigation is going on and these other investigations. And then that may or may not be the person that Democrats would select to run for the ticket in November, right?
That's right. That's right. And some talk has been given to Ohio Treasurer Rich Cordray being the person that would actually go up for election this fall as Attorney General, because he would be undercover. I mean, he could go run from cover. He would be able to go back to his job as Treasurer if he were not elected. So that the idea has been floated that maybe someone will be appointed by the governor. And that person will kind of sit in that spot for a while until the election and see what happens then.
I guess the advantage in the governor appointing an interim political non-entity, in a way, to head up the Attorney General's office is that if there's any sticky stuff coming out of these investigations, the candidate finally appointed by the Democrats or nominated by the Democrats would not have to be linked in the public mind with the Inspector General and the other investigations.
And that's an important point here, because we know that as this investigation goes on, the stories about what's happening at the AG's office, that those will continue. And whoever is the current AG will probably have their name linked with some of those stories, even if they didn't have a thing to do with it, just mm-hmm. because of their position.
Sure.
So that is a concern politically for the Democrats.
Oh, the Republicans must just be licking their chops.
They are. They are licking their chops. That's a good way to put it. They're talking about, Mark Dan as an example of someone who's not qualified, that the Democrats put Mark Dan up there, and, that that's too little too late what they're doing as far as, trying to get him out of office, what they've done in the past with impeachment and that sort of thing. It's just, another example of flawed leadership by the Democrats, according to the Republicans.
At 614-292-8513, we're joined by Becky. Hi, Becky. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a quick question. I think I remember that Betty Montgomery was a pretty popular attorney general.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, from thinking about the possibility, I know it's far-fetched, of a bipartisan effort, would she have been seen as having done a good job by the Democrats as well as the Republicans?
Well, the Democrats would probably not perceive her as doing a good job, since they ran such a strong campaign against her when Mark Dan ran for office. But one thing about Betty Montgomery is during the past 12 hours, she has said that she is not interested in taking over the Attorney General's office again. So she's not on the table at this point.
Okay. Thanks.
Becky, thanks for your call. So Betty Montgomery says she's not interested. Did she say why?
She said that she's not really interested in taking over the position. She had issued a press release through her press person, Mark Weaver. She just really doesn't want to do it.
Maybe she doesn't want to go through another campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
She was ill for a while, I recall, some time back.
She did. She was ill for a while. She had some issues with, I can't remember the name of the disease, but it was some sort of neurological kind of disease. But that was not the reason that was cited in here.
Sure. So who are the Republicans, Joe? Who are they thinking of running for this spot?
Well, there's a list of people here that could possibly be that are, and this is all speculation,
sure.
Fred, because the governor is being very tight-lipped as far as who he might want in the back of his mind. He says he doesn't have a short list.
In fact, he didn't even – the speculation about Richard Cordray, the state treasurer, the governor did not, in his news conference yesterday following Mark Dan's resignation, he was not willing to bring up Richard Cordray's name.
No, he doesn't want to bring up any – those names have been brought up by other Democratic operatives during this whole investigation. But The Republicans are looking at several different people that could possibly do the job. One of them is former U.S. Senator Mike DeWine. Another is former Congresswoman Deborah Price, soon to be former Congresswoman.
Mm-hmm.
Delaware County Prosecutor David Yost, Warren County Prosecutor Rachel Hutzel, former U.S. Attorney and Lorain County Prosecutor Greg White, former U.S. Congressman Rob Portman.
Mm-hmm.
So those are folks that the Republicans are considering. The Democrats, on the other hand.
But interesting that Rob Portman has also been named as a possible running mate for Senator John McCain.
Yes, Rob Portman is one of the Republicans who often gets named for all kinds of advancement in his career. In the Democratic side, if we look at that, Columbus City Attorney Richard Pfeiffer, Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Bill Mason, Montgomery County Prosecutor Matthias Heck, Lucas County Prosecutor Julia Bates, and of course Subodh Chandra, who lost to Dan in the AG primary in 2006. He's expressed interest. He would like to be the interim and the candidate as well.
Well, what do we know about Subodh Chandra?
Well, Subodh Chandra, there were several newspapers at the time that actually endorsed him over Mark Dan. He has a background in financial affairs. He's been able to, he's worked primarily out of the Cleveland area. He felt like he was definitely the more qualified of the two, candidates that were on the ballot. But Mark Dan was the one who had the most name recognition. You've got to remember that, too. At that point, Mark Dan was out there constantly railing against Governor Taft, and his name was well established. So politically, from just that standpoint, Mark Dan was the more popular choice at that moment.
I suppose with a number of the people that we mentioned here this morning, like former Senator Mike DeWine, my guess is that we don't have any public statements from them indicating interest or lack of interest at this point.
No, we don't yet. Like I said, this is very sketchy at this point. We don't have, no one's really given a short list, if you would call it that. So everything's kind of speculative, and we're just waiting to see.
It's interesting, Governor Strickland, if we saw the television coverage of the, I guess you'd call it a press conference, or at least his answering questions after the Attorney General resigned. When he was asked what he was looking for in a new attorney, a general candidate, he almost gave a little laugh, and the first word was maturity.
Maturity. The question was barely asked before Governor Strickland blurted out the word maturity, and people around the table were kind of smirking because it was maturity and someone who's qualified and things that have been said that Mark Dan lacks. I mean, a lot of people have said in recent weeks that Mark Dan lacked the maturity, lacked the experience and the knowledge. And those are the things that Governor Strickland was talking about at the very beginning there.
When Mark Dan made his resignation statement yesterday, and of course immediately left the room in the company of his daughter who had stood by his side, I saw one press account which suggested that he left the room. Of course, he took no questions. One press account said that Governor Strickland looked stunned that, in fact, he had left and that the stage was solely the governor's. I didn't interpret his expression that way, at least as I saw it on television. Did you?
I didn't interpret it that way either. I think that Governor Strickland, the look that I would describe is a combination of saddened and frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
He just was kind of sullen at the whole idea of, having to go through this. But I didn't think he looked stunned at all.
No, I didn't either. It's interesting that the governor took the trouble and to express, and I guess considering he has a degree in the ministry and a degree in psychology, maybe this shouldn't be surprising, that he took the trouble to express sympathy for the pain, he said, of Mark Dan, of his family, employees, and others who have been affected by this whole situation.
Yes, he did. That has been an issue. I mean, Mark Dan has always said that he felt bad for the way his family have they've been treated out of because of this.
Well, let me ask you, in terms of, by the way, we have an email here from Carol. She says, what was the problem with that noon news conference yesterday that never happened? How does that happen? I was listening to WOSU at lunchtime and waiting for the news conference. It seemed odd. As a reporter, were you annoyed? Yeah, well, there was at least the media was saying there was going to be a noon news conference yesterday. Finally, it wound up at 4:45.
Right. What happened? One of the things that's important to note here, in the last 48 hours before Mark Dan resigned, a lot of newspapers were coming out with reports that his resignation was imminent. It was going to happen this afternoon, according to one newspaper on Tuesday. Then we, yesterday morning, one of the newspapers came out with a statement that said Mark Dan is going to have a news conference at noon, and mandatory press, if the press wants to be there and get this news conference, it's mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
So I placed a phone call to Jason Stanford, who is the, Mark Dan has his own people who handle communications and public relations in his office. But as far as impeachment and some of these other things that he considers political are concerned, he appointed Jason Stanford. And that
we should say that Jason Stanford is a Texas consultant.
Correct.
Who he recently appointed. He specializes in opposition research on Republicans. That is to say, finding some, apparently digging up some dirt that he can sling at the opposition.
Right, exactly. And research opposition is very important in a campaign if you want to sling dirt, because they can find all kinds of things to sling. But I had called Jason and I asked Jason about this, and he said, yes, there's something at noon. And I said, well, where is it? Well, we didn't have that. He said, I don't have the logistics set on that yet. So while we were waiting to find all of this information, I went to the Attorney General's office, where there were already reporters gathering. By the time noon came around, we had about 50 reporters over there still waiting for the Attorney General to come out and say something. His people, the Attorney General's people, didn't know anything about it. But then, because of the way Attorney General Dan had structured his communications, they might not necessarily know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone was there waiting to go live. People were going live at that point. I think a lot of public radio stations were carrying some live coverage. And Mark Dan did not come out and speak with reporters. We knew he was there, but he did not come out and speak with reporters. Finally, one of the people from Mark Dan's actual office came out and said, he's not coming out, guys. It's not happening.
Yeah.
So, it's one of these situations where, that reporters were misled into believing that something was going to happen, and it just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Almost the triggering event here could have been, at least among the triggering events, the articles of impeachment entered by House Democrats. And basically, Joe, what do those articles say?
Well, the articles, there are nine different articles. They talk about malfeasance. They talk about nonfeasance. They talk about all kinds of problems with impeachable offenses that they believe would – things that would be impeachable offenses that they thought were either mismanagement, that sort of thing. The problem with these, gross neglect of duty, for example, was one mm-hmm. of them. The problem with these, Republican House Speaker John Husted pointed out that they were vague, and he gave an example of the Article 5. He said basically that article says that while acting in his capacity, AG Dan failed to exercise due care to ensure the safety and security of state property. Now, that could, and I don't know, it didn't give the specifics, but that could be referring to problems with state vehicles by the former General Services Director, Anthony Gutierrez.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Dan was not, overseeing that. There were problems that happened under that watch. But as Speaker Husted, House Speaker Husted put it, it's so vague that if you look at the language, it could also apply to the loss of a data tape by an intern in the governor's office a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, it wouldn't be right to impeach Governor Strickland over something like that, but if that standard were applied literally, it could be used in that instance. So there were problems with those articles of impeachment, and that they were vague, and had this drug on longer, some of those problems would have probably come to light.
Jim, in the final minute here, I guess Mark Dan left the press conference and flew back on a friend's private plane back to Youngstown, where apparently he was met on the tarmac by his wife and other family members. And we don't know, I guess, anything about the former Attorney General's plans now.
Well, as far as we know, he's going back home to spend some time with his family. We do not know of a new job, as we pointed out in the beginning here. Certainly Governor Strickland and the Democratic leaders have not set him up with anything.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with the Ohio State House news reporter Joe Ingles for Ohio Public Radio about the issues surrounding the resignation of Attorney General Mark Dan. Joe, thanks very much for being with us this half hour.
Okay, well, thank you, Fred.
When we come back, Newsweek International editor Fareed Zakaria on the post-American world at listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus. Streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.